When one of Crittenden's senior officers saw the battle flag of the Marauders through his field glasses, he immediately rode over to Matthew's company.
Shift your company over to that ridge, Captain McAllister. You support those green troops from Illinois. They're gonna need your help.
Yes, sir.
All the remainder of that day, the Union troops threw themselves against the Confederate lines and were repulsed each time, sustaining heavy losses. The rebels were beginning to stiffen their lines and dig in, and the fighting was fierce. When night fell, the ground was littered with the dead and the wounded. Joe called for a ceasefire to gather the wounded, and the Union commander readily agreed.
I'll go.
You didn't even have to ask, Colonel.
Jamie walked among the dead in his section, looking for Matthew. He knelt by a wounded Union soldier and found the boy couldn't walk. One leg was badly mangled by a grape shot. Jamie picked him up and carried him through the Union lines into a field hospital. Nearly everyone knew who the big man with the black shirt and black waist-length leather jacket was, and the lines parted as he walked through. The field hospital fell silent as Jamie was shown in.
Colonel, put him here, please, sir, if you would.
Thank you, sir. I do thank you deeply.
It's all right, boy.
All you goddamn Southerners have to do is surrender, and it would really be all right.
Shut your mouth, soldier!
Jamie turned to see Crittenden himself step into the tent and walk up to him.
Thank you for bringing that lad in, sir. It was most kind of you.
Wars are savage, sir, but men don't have to be.
Well put, Colonel.
Both men looked at the boy Jamie had carried in. He was already out from laudanum, and the surgeon was lifting a saw to cut off his leg just above the knee.
General Wheeler asked to tell you that this ceasefire will hold until the ground is cleared of all wounded. I can't speak for the other commands, just this one.
Thank you, sir. Litter bearers, move it!
Paw!
Jamie turned to look at Matthew, a bloody bandage around his forehead and one sleeve of his jacket damp with blood, the arm hanging limp.
This is your son? Of course, I should have guessed.
Matthew limped to his father's side. Jamie caught him just as Matthew collapsed. A doctor rushed to the men and quickly cut away Matthew's jacket sleeve.
Well, he'll keep the arm, but he's out of this battle. Will you put him on that table over there, Colonel?
Jamie carried his son to the table and then walked back to where Crittenden stood.
Before this war is over, I may have grandsons fighting each other.
I know men who do.
Jamie didn't get to speak with his son that night, but left the hospital tent with the certain knowledge that at least one of his sons was out of the war for now. He had no idea that Ian, his oldest, was there also, but the unit he commanded was being held in reserve. As the year of 1862 drew to a bloody close, Ian would be called to the front at a place named Hell's Half Acre. Yankees and rebels fought to a virtual standstill for several days. A little ground would be taken, a little ground would be lost, and a little ground would be retaken. And the dead and the wounded continued to mount. On the next to last day of the year, Jamie and his marauders rode with General Wheeler's cavalry to attack at the rear of the Union forces. As dawn broke, they spied almost 400 federal supply wagons moving with only a light guard. Jamie and his over 500 men swept down and took the wagons after only a light skirmish. Jamie and the marauders took almost 800 prisoners, which included about 100 black men who were serving as drivers and laborers.
Go home! Go back to your units or head west and get out of this damnable war.
Do that include us Negroes, Colonel?
Of course it does. Just don't head south. That would be the wrong direction to take.
Those in Jamie's command who believed strongly in slavery had learned to curb their passions if they wished to remain a marauder. The unit was such a proud one with such a distinguished and colorful history, albeit a short one, that Jamie never lacked for volunteers. Once in, only death or a grievous wound would cause a man to leave. Jamie personally escorted the wagons back to the Confederate lines and turned it over to Wheeler's second-in-command. The wagons were filled with much-needed medicines, including a large supply of laudanum, along with warm clothing, even if it was the wrong color, food, and ammunition. An hour later, Wheeler rolled and rumbled in with an additional 200 wagons, filled with the same kind of supplies. It was a rich haul for the rebels, and a very demoralizing strike against the Union forces. And those two actions very nearly ended the fighting that day, except for light skirmishing. But the next day, the last day of 1862, the armies began massing for attack several hours before dawn. As the night gave way to a foggy dawn, Union pickets along the west side of the now backward L-shaped lines blinked their eyes and stared hard into the gray mist. All of them thought they'd seen gray shapes moving toward them, but the shapes quickly melted into the haziness of the morning, and the pickets didn't report what they felt was only an illusion. It was not an illusion. It was 12,000 gray-clad rebels moving to attack on the west side of Stones River, between Franklin Road and Wilkinson Pike. At the curve of the backward-shaped L, one full division of Confederates were supposed to attack at the same time, theoretically severing the Union lines. Had that happened, the terrible battle yet to come would have been avoided, and the rebels would have secured a clear victory. But the commanding general of that crucial division of rebels was drunk that morning, having consumed about a half a gallon of Tennessee brewed Who Hit John the night before. He couldn't even get on his horse, much less command troops. Since the lines had shifted dramatically during the night, with the Federals pulling back and regrouping, Jamie and his marauders were now at the extreme north end at the top of the backward L, facing a regiment of Crittenden's men on the east side of the river.
Now, how in the hell did we manage this?
I don't know, but here they come!
The marauders had dismounted and formed up in a line. They laid down a withering fire that stopped the Federal advance cold on the west bank of the river. The first volley killed or wounded several hundred Union soldiers. The blue line pulled back and stayed back. On the south side of the Union lines, the right side of the oddly shaped lines, rebels had advanced and pushed the Union forces back until they were in full retreat. For several hours, the blue and gray smashed at each other. Badly outnumbered to begin with, Confederate losses were now so great that every troop being held in reserve was called up and committed to the fight. Shortly after noon of that bloody day, the Federal lines had been hammered into a V shape, the V surrounded on all three sides by hard-fighting rebels. Jamie had gathered together, in addition to his own men, about four companies of rebels who had been cut off from their units or were leaderless due to the many wounded and dead. He sent little Ben Pardee to General Breckinridge asking for permission to cross the river and close the top of the V, thereby completely boxing in the Union forces. But Breckinridge could not be found. He was right in the middle of his men on the ground by the river, fighting with a pistol in each hand, his color bearer right beside him holding the Confederate battle flag. Ben did find a colonel who told him to race back to McAllister with orders to hold, by God, hold.
Hold what, goddammit? We've got him on a route! You ride back to that colonel and tell him that, Ben!
But the colonel was dead, shot through the head. Jamie could do nothing except hold, for he had no one to support him if he crossed the river. By 2 o'clock that afternoon, the Federal V had begun to straighten out somewhat. Jamie was still on the east side of the river, but he was now facing a full division of Union troops. For all intents and purposes, Jamie's men had been forgotten. But so too had the Yankee General Price, who had a full division all ready to cross the river at the only fording place for a mile in either direction. But Price thought he was facing a division of the Butternut Boys, for Jamie had sent men back down the line to beg, borrow, and steal as many cannon as they could. Jamie started a cannonade that sent Price's men ducking for cover. Price sent out a message that read, "Am facing a full division of rebels with artillery. Need help desperately in order to cross the river. Orders?" The orders came back. "Hold on to the west side." Bragg had been reinforced by some three brigades who had just arrived. Dust began to settle. He ordered a charge against Yankee positions at the center of the line. Fresh troops charged point blank against the guns of the Federals. The charge was a terrible blunder, and the Confederates were forced to withdraw. They had lost almost half of the men from the three fresh brigades. That ended the battle for that day. Both sides could not have fought another minute had their commanders given the orders to do so. Confederate and Union soldiers simply collapsed where they were, too exhausted to go on. After an hour of rest, both sides began evacuating the wounded. General Bragg, commander of the Confederate forces, engaged in battle at Stones River, sent a message to Jefferson Davis in Richmond, wishing him a Happy New Year. Then he retired to his tent and went to bed. The battlefield was littered with thousands of wounded. Since the killing field was so long, stretching for several miles, many of the wounded did not receive aid until the next day. Still others froze to death, their bodies sealing them to the cold ground. A ceasefire had been ordered from both sides. Rebels aided wounded Yanks, and Yanks aided wounded rebels. Nearby towns were filled with the injured, no one paying attention to the color of the uniforms. Makeshift hospitals were set up, and the doctors were so busy sawing off mangled arms and legs, a lot of the severed limbs were just tossed out the nearest window. No one on either side slept much that bitterly cold night, for both sides were busy regrouping their exhausted and widely scattered troops. Many of the troops were short on food and ammunition, but it was desperate on the Union side, due to those hundreds of wagons that had been seized by Jamie and Wheeler, containing badly needed supplies. Dawn broke gloomy and sunless, and the men were simply too cold, too hungry, and too tired to pick up the fight. Both sides finally rose stiffly to their boots and roamed the miles of battlefield, picking through the equipment and taking what could be used, and that included taking weapons and ammunition off of the stiffened and frozen dead. Few shots were fired at Stones River on that first day of the year 1863. During the night came the rain, then sleet, and then the whole mess turned to snow, making life even more miserable for the blue and the gray. But on the second day of the new year, the commanders roused their men and the battle resumed. Fighting commenced at about 12 o'clock in the midst of a raging sleet storm. Jamie and his men had been ordered back to plug up a gap in the Confederate lines. Jamie now commanded over 1,000 men with some 30 pieces of horse-drawn artillery. He forded the river and positioned his men on a ridge near the center of the now U-shaped Union lines. And without orders, nobody really had orders other than to attack, opened fire with his cannons until he was forced to halt the barrage for fear of hitting rebel troops who were charging across an open field and up a slide hill. Leaving a captain in command, Jamie and his marauders mounted up and joined the charge. They broke through the Federal lines, putting the Union troops into a retreat. Cresting the hill, Jamie stared at what seemed to be thousands of blue-coated men running to help plug the hole the rebels had torn in their lines. The rebels thought they had the Yankees on the run. From where he sat on his horse, Jamie knew better.
Fall back and take up positions on the hill!
No! By God, sir, we have them on the run! Charge! Fall back!
Waving his saber, the rebel colonel ordered the charge to continue. They charged straight to their deaths. The foolhardy colonel took a bullet in the head and was dead seconds after he ordered the charge. That seemed to turn the tide for the blue. They mustered up their courage and began pushing the gray back on all fronts. As night fell, the Confederate officers managed to halt the retreat and turn their weary and bloodied men around. They were out of food, out of ammunition, and very nearly out of hope. At the breaking of dawn, Jamie's scouts brought back prisoners with more disheartening news.
They've been reinforced all during the night. They've got almost 80,000 men. We'll be lucky to field 20,000. It's over, General Bragg.
God help us. Retreat. Fall back. Chattanooga must be saved.
Jamie's marauders and Wheeler's cavalry stayed to act as rear guard as the weary rebels picked up their gear and began moving out toward the east. They left behind them over 12,000 dead and wounded comrades. The battleground was still littered with the dead and the dying. The Union forces did not immediately pursue the retreating Confederate army. Jamie and his marauders were the last to leave Hell's Half Acre. Sparks twisted in his saddle for one last look at the still smoky killing field.
What the hell did all that death and suffering accomplish? Nothing. Absolutely nothing at all.
Jamie had lost 20 men killed and 15 wounded during the battle. But as usual, he was back up to strength within a week as volunteers flooded in to join the Marauders. Bragg ordered him to take his Marauders and roam from border to border of this state, wreaking havoc on any Union soldiers who might dare to pursue us. Jamie had learned that Matthew had recovered fully from his wounds and was once more commanding a company of Union cavalry. Ian had been promoted, and he had his own command of cavalrymen. Jorge and Tomas Nunez were with Hood and were heading toward Chattanooga. Pat McKenzie and Sam Montgomery Jr. had arrived as part of an advance unit and were in central Tennessee. Sweet and Hannah's boy, Igamar, was with the Iowa 5th. Jamie had troubles that he was unaware of in the form of one Colonel Aaron Layfield, a blue-nosed Yankee who hated all Southerners with something that far surpassed mere fanaticism. He hated anything and everybody south of the Mason-Dixon line. His idol was John Brown, whom he considered to be the second finest man to ever walk the face of the earth. The first was Jesus Christ. The third was himself. Aaron Layfield was the organizer and commanding officer of something called the Pennsylvania Revengers, a unit of brigade strength made up of rabid anti-slavers and anti-everything Southern, and they were fast approaching Tennessee. Aaron Layfield considered himself to be a very religious man, a person who insisted upon his men praying before every meal and Bible reading before retiring for the night. Every man in his command considered himself to be an extension of the arm of the Lord, and of course they interpreted the Bible to suit their own bloody aims. Aaron Layfield was not originally from Pennsylvania. No one knew exactly where he was born, but he had lived there for a number of years, where he had run a variety store 6 days a week and filled the pulpits on Sunday, where his church was well attended. The town just loved the hellfire and brimstone spouting radical. Layfield and his heavily armed brigade, complete with horse-drawn artillery, rode south. They had information as to what towns were sympathetic toward the Southern cause. So far, the Revengers had burned and looted and sacked half a dozen towns, killed several hundred men, either shooting or hanging or dragging them to death, and terribly abused several dozen women. All in God's name, of course. During the long ride south, Layfield picked up several hundred more volunteers along the way, swelling his ranks with fanatics, all of whom waved Bibles in one hand and pistols in the other, shouting out hate to anyone who would listen. Fortunately, that wasn't many, but enough did, and his ranks continued to grow as he pressed on through the mountains of West Virginia and Kentucky, gathering not only men and supplies, but pocketfuls of money from people who fell under his snake oil charm. Layfield especially hated one man in particular, a man who had lived with the godless, savage Indians and had adopted many of their heathenish ways, as well as turning his back on the Union to fight for the Confederacy. Jamie Ian McAllister. Layfield was God's appointed punisher. God had told him so, personally and up close. And to prove it to anyone who might doubt it, during his services, Layfield sometimes got the spirit and talked in tongues. Most Pennsylvanians thought Layfield to be about as full of shit as a fattening Christmas turkey. But there are always a few who would follow. In this case, a few too many. The long, cold winter drifted by with only the occasional raid by one side or the other. The war on all fronts seemed to lag for a time. General Rosecrans' Army of the Cumberland still had Chattanooga to wrest from General Bragg's Army of Tennessee, but he seemed to be in no hurry to do so. Meanwhile, Bragg was slowly rebuilding his army, while Grant was sending wire after wire to Washington, demanding more men be sent to him down at Vicksburg. The only troops in Tennessee active during the winter months were the Confederate cavalry. Bragg had just over 16,000 men mounted, and he used them with great effectiveness. He sent Joe Wheeler, Nathan Bedford Forrest, Morgan's Raiders, and Jamie's Marauders on rampage after rampage all over central Tennessee, especially against the railroad, which was busy night and day supplying General Rosecrans' army. As the warm breezes began to blow, signaling an end to the bitter winter, the commanders of the two great armies in Tennessee started making plans for attack. Rosecrans knew that Chattanooga must be taken, for it was a vital railroad link. Bragg was not going to give it up without one whale of a fight. Rosencrantz knew nothing of Colonel Layfield's reputation and his hatred of anything pertaining to the South. He was just glad to have the reinforcements of such a capable-looking group of cavalry, for more reasons than one. Rosencrantz himself was a deeply religious man, a convert to Catholicism, and he was glad to have another man so firmly committed to the Lord in its command, even if the man was a Protestant.
I want you to concentrate on finding and destroying Jamie McAllister and his band of marauders, Colonel Layfield.
You can count on me, sir. The Union must be preserved and kept from the bloody and lawless hands of the brigands from the South. Tell me, sir, is it true that McAllister actually worships the pagan gods of the red savages he once lived with?
I have heard that.
The goddamn heathen!
Layfield's outburst had caused Rosencrantz's aides in the next room to stop what they were doing and look up. Rosencrantz blinked at that, but said nothing about it, figuring that every man had his own idiosyncrasies.
Good luck, Colonel Layfield.
I don't believe in luck, sir, for I have God with me at all times.
Vicksburg was a surrounded and besieged city, with only a few more days to exist as a Confederate stronghold. It would fall on July the 4th, after weeks of fighting, with the Confederate forces trapped there, scarcely able to function, soldier and citizen alike staggering from sickness, exhaustion, and hunger. Gettysburg would also be a major Union victory in July, but in Tennessee, the fighting had just begun.
Do you know a man named Aaron Layfield?
I don't think so. I'm not familiar with that name. Why, Sparks?
Well, he's sworn to kill you. Says that if he only accomplishes one thing during this war, he will consider it a great event and a day for celebration if he kills you.
Well, that's odd. I never heard of the man. Who is he?
He's from a town up in Pennsylvania named after him. He came south with a full brigade of cavalry. They're called the Revengers.
Well, I've never met anyone named Layfield. This war is certainly producing some strange characters.
Including our beloved general.
Jamie couldn't argue with that. General Bragg was one of, if not the, most disliked man in all the Confederate Army. Jamie swung into the saddle.
I'm gonna take a look around. I can't believe that General Rosecrans has waited this long to attack.
It was June 23rd, and the sky was threatening rain. The two great armies were lined up about 35 miles apart. The front was miles long, stretching north to south, and each side was constantly patrolling. Chattanooga was about 90 miles east of Bragg's westernmost position, and Bragg was determined to hold the Yankees at bay. The Union forces under Rosencrantz's command now numbered around 80,000. Bragg's troops had dwindled down to about 38,000 due to the shifting of much-needed troops to various other hot spots, including Vicksburg. Several miles out into no man's land, Jamie spotted a small Union patrol and reined up in the timber, uncasing his field glasses and studying the patrol. He smiled. Tying a white bandana onto his rifle, he rode out of the timber and into the clearing. He was spotted immediately, and Jamie Ian recognized the rider as his father.
Hold your fire! I know who that is, and we're going to talk. Come on, I'll introduce you to a living legend.
Who is it, Captain?
My father.
Howdy, boy.
Pa.
The two men rode close, leaned out of the saddle, and shook hands.
Matt told me he saw you some months back, but his memory was sort of fuzzy about that night.
Is he all right?
Fiddle fine, Pa. I got a batch of letters from Ma. Meet me here tomorrow and I'll give them to you to raid.
Best not, son. Your general might call that fraternizing with the enemy. You saved them for me.
All right, Pa. Pa? You're on the wrong side, damn it. You know what you're doing isn't right.
It is to my mind, boy, as well as Falcon and Jorge and Tomas.
All right, Pa. You seen my little brother lately?
Last week. He's fine.
Who's he riding with?
Jamie smiled at Miller, although he had taken an immediate dislike to the man. He returned his gaze to Ian and started to say something when the sergeant suddenly rammed his horse close to Jamie.
I asked you a question, Reb, and you goddamn well answer it.
Before Ian could order the man back, his father hit the sergeant, knocking him clean out of the saddle.
Miller, I'll have you court-martialed for this. Colonel McAllister rode up here under flag of truce.
The big sergeant got slowly to his boots, blood leaking from his smashed lips.
Get off that horse and I'll kick your ass, Colonel Reb.
You're not worth the effort it would take, Sergeant. Now cool down before you get into real trouble.
I don't take orders from no goddamn stinking Reb.
You're a fool.
Place that man under arrest!
Carl Miller jumped to his horse.
The hell with you all!
Let him go!
We've seen the last of Carl Miller in good riddance. I never did like that man. Sorry about that, Pa.
Forget it. I had a few men like him in my outfit at first. They didn't last long.
I believe it.
Father and son sat their saddles for a moment looking at each other. Both of them had a lot they would have liked to say, but neither man could put their feelings into words.
Gonna start raining soon, boy.
Yeah. Sure looks like it, Pa.
Well, boy, you take care of yourself, and you be sure to write your mother whenever you have time.
I'll sure do that, Pa.
I'll tell Falcon I spoke to you.
Well, you give him my best, Pa.
Jamie turned his horse and rode slowly back towards his own sector. At Timber's Edge, he turned in the saddle. Bean was leading his patrol back toward his own lines. Father and son had passed no hard words, but the meeting had been a tad on the strained side. If they all came out of this war alive, Jamie felt it would take some time before the family was whole again. It would take a lot of healing. The battle for Chattanooga began in a driving rain on the afternoon of June 24, 1863, when General Rosecrans threw his entire army at the Confederates. Rosecrans had armed many of his men with the relatively new 7-shot Spencer rifle, while most of the rebels still used the older model single-shot rifle, and many of them had converted muskets to shotguns. The Confederate line broke at several points, and the Union forces swept through, cutting vital rebel supplies and communication links. The rain didn't stop. It rained almost constantly for 3 days. For 3 days, the heavily outnumbered rebels took a beating from the Yankees. The rain finally stopped, but the mud was knee-deep on many of the roads. Even that didn't stop the determined Union forces. They marched on, taking only a few casualties while inflicting some terrible damage on the Confederates. On the 1st of July, General Bragg ordered his men to start retreating into the mountains of East Tennessee, putting the Tennessee River between them and the slowly but steadily approaching Yankees. Jamie and his men were on the north, or the right side of the rebel line, and his scouts reported that a huge force of Union troops were fast advancing toward him, coming down from Kentucky. 2 weeks later, Knoxville fell, and the troops there were ordered out and told to fall back to Chattanooga. Caught between two huge advancing armies, unable to reach Chattanooga and without orders, Jamie and his marauders slipped through enemy lines and rode into North Georgia. There, Jamie and his men linked up with a rebel force advancing north to aid Bragg in his defense of East Tennessee, General James Longstreet and his army. In Longstreet's command tent, Jamie pointed to a spot on a map.
The tracks have been destroyed from this point on. It's march from here on in.
All right. You and your man spearhead, Colonel. This place right here looks like a good spot to make a stand. It appears ideal. What's it called?
It's an Indian name, sir. Chickamauga. It means River of Blood.
Jamie and Longstreet arrived just in time to take part in the bloodiest fighting along the Chickamauga, and during the late afternoon, the stream did run red with the blood of the blue and the gray. Even though it was not yet true fall, somebody forgot to tell Mother Nature, and the weather took a turn for the worse. Neither side was dressed for the cold, and both sides suffered during the near-freezing night. With the addition of Longstreet, the rebels now outnumbered the Yankees, but just by the barest of margins. Longstreet wanted to attack at first light, for his men were spoiling for a fight, and Bragg agreed and gave the order for the division on the rebel right to charge at dawn. The rest would follow in waves. But dawn came and went, and nothing happened. Jamie sent little Ben Pardee back to find out what was wrong. Pardee found General Bragg fit to be tied.
How the hell should I know what's happened? Go find that goddamn Polk. His division is supposed to open this dance.
When Ben Pardee reported back to Jamie, there was a very puzzled look on his young face.
What's the matter? What's the delay?
General Polk is waiting for his breakfast.
Somebody get me a bowl of mush and I'll ride over and hand feed the son of a bitch!
No one dared to bring Longstreet any mush, for the general would have done just what he threatened to do. Both armies waited for the other to make a move. Any element of surprise the Confederates might have had was now long gone. At about 8:30, Jamie sent Little Ben riding over to once more check on Polk. Little Ben reported back.
His aide said he was in the woods taking his morning constitutional.
This whole damn war waits for him to take a crap.
The battle finally got underway just after 10 that morning, when a Union general made a terrible mistake in tactics and shifted his full division, leaving a gap in Yankee lines. Longstreet shifted Jamie and his marauders around to beef up Forrest's men, fighting at the extreme north end of the rebel lines, about 4 miles away from the heaviest fight. Then Longstreet plunged his entire command straight into the gaping hole and broke the Union lines. Miles to the north, Husky listened to the faint sounds of battle.
What's that saying about always a bridesmaid but never a bride?
Yeah, that's us, all right.
Sparks, holler across the road to those Union troops all dug in and let's get this thing going.
Hey, you Yankees gonna fight or not?
Try this on for size.
Well, at least we know they're over there. Pardee, find Forrest and ask him what we're supposed to be doing.
Pardee returned a few minutes later.
His orders are to harass the enemy and hold.
A man could interpret those orders in a lot of ways, Colonel.
Somebody getting right into the thick of things.
Well, hell, Colonel.
That's coming from the north of us. Whose command is way up there?
There ain't supposed to be anyone up there. We're the northernmost unit.
Now, what the hell is all that about?
Ben, where'd you find Forrest?
About 3/4 of a mile south of us, sir. Down yonder on the road.
Suddenly, the woods to the north of Jamie's position filled with blue-coated cavalrymen as they burst out into the clearing, waving sabers and pistols in the classic mounted charge.
Companies 3 and 4, wheel to face the infantry dug in. Companies 1 and 2, follow me!
Colonel Layfield had been briefed that Jamie and the marauders did not like to face the taste of cold steel in a cavalry charge. He'd been told they would cut and run. The South Hater had been badly misinformed. Two companies of marauders led by Jamie smashed into Layfield's as yet to be battle-tested revengers. The marauders were badly outnumbered, but they were to a man experienced fighters. Jamie rode right into the midst of things, both hands filled with colts. Union saddles were being emptied at an alarming rate under the fury of the marauders. Layfield looked around for his bugler. He couldn't be found.
Fall back! Regroup!
Little Ben Pardee triggered off a round from his pistol.
Ah, shit!
Bullet ricocheted off the back of Layfield's saddle and took a small piece of his pompous ass with it before sailing back. Layfield, waving his saber, managed to get his revengers gone from the clear.
Sound recall! No pursuit! Recall, Gibson!
Forrest had heard the heavy firing and came galloping up, his command right behind him. And while Layfield's attack had failed miserably, the Union troops across the road had been beefed up. For Forrest, the charge across the road would have been suicide. All he could do was hold. He jumped off his horse and walked up to Jamie, who was bleeding from a slight head wound. A doctor tended to him.
Who the hell was that just attacked us?
I just received word that a brigade called the Revengers was moving into place north of here. Had to have been them.
Layfield's bunch.
You and your boys put them on the route, Jamie.
I shot a colonel in the ass.
The next day, the rebels put the Yankees into full retreat. But while it could be called a Confederate victory, the cost in human life was terribly high. Bragg had lost more than 19,000 men killed, wounded, or taken prisoner. The Union Army had lost more than 17,000 men killed, wounded, or taken prisoner. Chickamauga proved to be the bloodiest battle of the war. Jamie's men had seized a train of supply wagons on the third day during the Union's retreat. And it was a boon. The wagons were filled with the new Colt revolving rifles and the new Spencer repeating rifles. Jamie's Marauders became the most heavily armed cavalry unit in the Confederate Army, now being able to wheel, dismount, and lay down an awesome field of fire. Layfield, meanwhile, was unable to ride due to the wound suffered in the right cheek of his buttocks. He found that the greatest balm for the pain in his ass was his ever-growing hatred of Jamie Ian McAllister. But the siege of Chattanooga was underway, and it was to be a miserable time for a civilian and soldier alike. The soldiers had little to eat, and the civilians had less. The Union supply lines were being constantly harassed by the rebels, and before it was all over, some civilians and soldiers would starve to death. During the first couple of months after the Battle of Chickamauga, many drastic changes took place within both the Union and Confederate armies. Grant became the commanding general of all three armies operating in Tennessee, and he pulled them all under a single military force. He replaced Rosecrans and sent him home to Ohio. On the rebel side, Davis still refused to replace Bragg. Instead, he shifted several ranking generals around and left Bragg in command, much to the disgust of all. Grant now turned all his attentions toward clearing East Tennessee of all rebels, and during the last week of October, he put that plan into action. Jamie and his marauders had been ordered up close to Knoxville, where the Union General Burnside was headquartered. Jamie didn't know it, but Bragg had learned that Jamie had some fairly strong opinions of Bragg's ability to command, and this was Bragg's way of getting rid of Jamie. 2 days later, he would order Longstreet and his force to hit the trail for Knoxville. Finally, Bragg would be rid of Longstreet and Joe Wheeler and his cavalry. Wheeler was attached to Longstreet. The two generals were the most outspoken against Bragg. Burnside was ordered to hold Knoxville at all costs.
Stupid. Knoxville is pro-Union. We'll get no support from the citizens there.
Jamie's wiretapper had hooked into the lines and scurried back down with the news.
Well, Longstreet and Wheeler have been ordered up to Knoxville, Colonel. They're coming up by train, about a week behind us.
Now, I know Bragg is a damn fool. We'll never be able to hold Knoxville with such a small force, even if we do take it. And Bragg will never beat back the Federals at Chattanooga after cutting his force. What the hell is the man trying to do, lose the war single-handedly?
Jamie and his men waited for Longstreet and joined the man's forces in the middle of November. He was assigned to Wheeler's cavalry and immediately began harassing the Union forces stationed along the river and stealing their food and equipment. For the supplies that Bragg promised to send never came, and winter was covering the land. Longstreet never admitted openly that he felt all was lost in Tennessee, but Jamie could read sign better than most and could often see it in the man's stance and in the timbre of his voice. Longstreet's men lacked proper winter clothing, and the shoes and boots of many were falling apart, the men having to tie rags around their feet. Still, no one suggested they give up the fight. Inside the city, many Union troops were faring no better than the Confederates, for Jamie and his marauders were raising hell with the supply boats on the Holston River, managing to seize about one out of three every week. But even those supplies barely kept body and soul alive. Longstreet's men were forced to fish the dead carcasses of horses and mules from the river and eat them. Longstreet called for a meeting of his commanders during the last week of November, 1863. It had turned bitterly cold, and the rain had changed to sleet. Longstreet's face was grim under his heavy beard.
I have just received word that Chattanooga is about to fall. It may have fallen by this time. I don't know where Bragg is, and I have no orders. Telegraph lines have been cut, and as far as I know, we are alone.
We should fall out and retreat back to Virginia.
We have no supplies or support, and wind is already getting the better of us. We need to connect with a larger army and consolidate.
The last order I received was to fight, and fight we shall. We strike at the city tomorrow morning.
In less than 30 minutes' time, Longstreet lost 1,000 men. He called off the attack, and after a brief pause, ordered his soldiers to begin an orderly retreat. The terrain was unsuitable for cavalry tactics, so Jamie squatted on a ridge and watched the massacre through field glasses, his marauders packed up and ready to go, waiting some yards behind him. Jamie had seen similar sights outside the walls of the Alamo, viewed the carnage without change of expression. Telegraph wires had been repaired, and he had heard only moments before the brief battle began Chattanooga had indeed fallen. Bragg's men were now retreating into Georgia.
Is it over?
In more ways than one. Let's go.
Where to, Colonel?
Georgia.
During the grim year of 1863, the war had taken a heavy toll. Among the dead was Stonewall Jackson, killed at Chancellorsville, a death that was mourned throughout the entire Confederacy. For the first few months of the new year, the Confederate Army was in disarray, with retreats on nearly all fronts. The Army of Virginia was holding, but cracks were appearing even there as the Union Army grew stronger. Longstreet had been shifted up to Virginia to reinforce the rebels there. Robert E. Lee was now recognized as the overall commander of the Confederate Army. President Lincoln had called for volunteers to aid in the fight against the rebels, and more than 500,000 men had lined up to enlist. Jamie found himself without orders and attached to no particular division. In the haste to reorganize, the Marauders had been left out of the plan. The spring of 1864 brought with it several of the most unusual and least written about events of the bloody struggle. Colonel Aaron Layfield loudly and publicly stated to anyone who would listen that once the war in the East was over and the Union was victorious, he was going to take his men out west and stamp out any lingering pockets of rebels and then turn his attention to the Indians and wipe them out. Jamie found the latter highly amusing, for Layfield would last about a day against the Ute or the Cheyenne or the Dakota or any of dozens of other tribes. Then Layfield specifically mentioned Valley, Colorado and the McAllister clan, calling the area a hotbed of insurrection filled with southern whores, white trash, and traitors fit only to be wiped from the face of the earth, and the land they squat upon burned bare, and the earth salted down so nothing will ever live there again. Jamie and his men were camped in North Georgia, with no orders from the Confederate High Command. They had seemingly fallen through the cracks of the military bureaucracy. Jamie had lost his temper when he rode the train down to Atlanta to try to find out what they were supposed to do. He kept getting the runaround, and when he did get to see a senior officer, the man didn't have the foggiest idea what to do. So Jamie decided to send the smooth-talking Pierre Dupree to see if he could find out something. Dupree found out a lot of things, including the reason for Layfield's wild hatred of Jamie Ian McAllister. He'd been bankrolled by a rich turncoat Louisiana man named Jubal Olmsted, who was in cahoots with the Yankees, and they promised him the governorship of Louisiana once the war's over. This Olmsted fellow's originally from Kentucky, I think, and for whatever reason, he has a God Almighty deep hatred for you, Colonel.
Dear God, is it ever gonna end?
Over coffee, Jamie told his men the long and twisted story of Kate's father and brother and all their kin, and about the Jacksons and the Saxons and the Newbies and all the rest of the men who carried a blood feud against him.
What about orders?
I finally got in to see a General Carson, and he said he didn't have the authority to order us to do nothing, Colonel. We don't even show up on any official war documents that he has, and he's got a whole damn room full of them.
So, officially, we can do whatever we damn well please?
Well, I reckon so, Colonel.
Including maybe going after this damn Layfield, if we was to decide to do such a thing, that is?
But, if we don't exist, Colonel, we can't draw supplies. I'm not worried about getting paid. Confederate money ain't worth a damn anyway. But how will we get supplies?
Steal them. From our own boys?
Well, here comes Husky.
He coming back mighty early.
Colonel, I don't want you to think me a quitter, but I would like to be discharged from this outfit. I got me some manhunting to do.
Have some coffee and food, Louie. Let's talk about it.
Husky calmed down enough to eat a plate of bacon and beans and swallow two cups of coffee.
That town I went to, Colonel, it ain't there no more. Burned to the ground. What men they didn't shoot, they hanged. And then they had their way with a lot of the women who didn't run off into the woods. And they branded them on the forehead with a W for whore. They hanged my brother. Only reason he didn't join up with the Confederacy was because he was born with a club foot. He didn't get around too good.
Who did all this, Lewis?
I can answer that. Colonel Aaron Layfield and his revengers.
That's right, Colonel. I'm gonna kill that man. If it's the last thing I do on God's earth, I'm gonna kill him.
One of us will. Sparks, I want you to pick five other men to change into civilian clothing and get ready to take a trip.
Sure, Colonel. Where to?
New York City.
Somebody get me pen and ink and paper.
What's up, Colonel?
We're gonna have us a very private and personal little war, Top. That's what Layfield wants. A private and personal war with me. None of you have to go on this. It's strictly volunteer all the way.
Shit, Colonel. You think any of us would miss this?
Sparks, you and the men you choose will be bringing back $100,000 in gold and federal paper money from my personal account. One of many, I assure you.
Jamie started writing to his banker and attorney in New York City. If Layfield wanted a war, he was damn sure gonna get one. Jamie took a few men with him and rode over to where the town used to be. It was exactly as Top had said, burned to the ground. There were several dozen fresh graves in the cemetery, and the ropes used to hang the men were still dangling from the limbs of trees. Husky had marked his brother's grave and now set about carving him a wooden marker until he could get a stonemason to chisel a permanent stone. Jamie walked the paths of what had once been a permanent settlement. Now there was nothing except the smell of ashes and death. Jamie looked up as an elderly black man made his way toward Jamie.
What army is ye?
The Army of the Confederacy.
Them Yankee soldiers didn't have no call to do this. I never seen so many white men so filled plumb up with hate again their own kind.
The tall, loud-mouthed man with side whiskers leading the bunch?
Yes, sir. He personally took the hot iron and branded the first lady on the forehead. That was after his men had their way with the white ladies that didn't run off. Them men of his, they lined up to take their turns with the ladies. Some of them, they raped no more than chilling.
The men who did this were not really Union soldiers.
They wasn't?
No. Most soldiers of the blue are like the soldiers of the gray. They wouldn't have any part of rape and torture.
The men who done this, they rampaged through all the stores and homes before they put them to the torch. They give the money and the finery to any colored folks they could find. Most of the colored folks I know threw them clothes away. They feared of being punished if they was caught with it later. The money ain't no good. It's Confederate money.
Where do you live?
Nowheres now. Them bluecoats burned down the master's house and stole the horses and mules. They gathered up all the livestock and took them when they left. Master Nations, he dead, and so is his wife. The bluecoats killed them both. They wasn't no call to do that, because they was both old and didn't treat us bad like a lot of white folks do. Tell me, sir, is it true that President Lincoln done freed all the slaves?
Yep. It's called the Emancipation Proclamation. You're free.
Lord have mercy. You mean I could just walk down that road as far as I want to go?
Well, yep.
Well, what do I do when I gets to where it is I might be going? That is, if I had anywheres I wanted to go.
Jamie then realized the enormity of what Lincoln had done. What he had done was a wonderful thing. Only a hate-filled fool would deny that. But on the other side of the coin, with one stroke of the pen, Lincoln had turned loose millions of Negroes who had no training, no jobs, most of whom could not read or write, and had no place to go in a part of the country torn and ripped by war and hatred.
Got no real money. How am I gonna eat? I'm hungry, mister.
We have some food with us. We'll share with you.
But that's today. What about tomorrow? And the next day? And the day after that?
You're on your own. You're free. All you can do is part of being free. Plant a garden. Hire yourself out for wages.
I'll be somewheres around 80 years old. Hands all stiff and no good to work no more. All I knew was working in the fields, lifting and toting. Something ain't quite right about this here freedom. Seemed like Mr. Lincoln done a good thing with one hand and put a terrible burden on us with the other hand.
Come on, I'll get you some food.
No, sir. I best not. I got to be looking after myself from now on, so I best be getting to doing it. I know where there's some greens, and I'll get that and some poke. I'll get back.
Jamie stood and watched the old man shuffle off into the woods.
I'll be damned.
You say something, Colonel?
Just talking to myself, Tom.
Now what, Colonel?
We go after Layfield.
Jamie took his marauders into the mountainous section of East Georgia, and there holed up until Sparks and the others could return from New York City. Jamie began sending out men dressed in civilian clothing and riding the poorest of stock to act as spies to learn the whereabouts of Layfield and his revengers. Layfield, meanwhile, was busy looking for Jamie, but he was over in central Tennessee in North Alabama, several hundred miles away from Jamie's position. For a time, the war seemed far away to Jamie and his men. They hunted and fished and picked berries and mended clothing and did all the other things that soldiers do when not fighting, including waiting. It was late spring before Sparks and the men returned, laden with gold and federal paper money. The men were very relieved to be rid of all that money.
That New York City is some place, Colonel. I sure hadn't ever seen anything like it, and I'm not sure I ever want to see it again. Too damn many people to suit this country, boy.
Jamie had heard no real news of the war, and Sparks brought him up to date.
Forrest really got the Yankees all riled up against us after that raid on Fort Pillar.
What raid?
Happened a few weeks ago just north of Memphis. Forrest and his boys stormed the place and took it, but the Yankees is saying it was a slaughter. The newspapers back east are saying that Forrest's boys bayoneted and clubbed to death most of the colored soldiers because they was fighting for the blue. The Yankees lost more than 300 men, most of them blacks, according to the newspapers, that is.
It might have happened that way, too. Nathan's got some boys fighting with him that hate colored people. Some of them were with us originally, if you recall.
Sherman is sending troops out to forage, Colonel. And sometimes they're right cruel to the civilians.
Are they paying for what they take?
Sometimes, but not often. In something they call script.
During the first week in May 1864, General Sherman launched his Georgia campaign, and Grant crossed the Rapidan, signaling the beginning of the campaign against Lee in Virginia. Jamie and the Marauders rode off to tangle with Layfield and his revengers. When Sherman learned that Layfield was going to wage a personal war against Jamie McAllister, he smiled.
Now, well, maybe that pompous bag of wind can keep McAllister occupied enough so we'll not have time to harass us. Aide, take this down as a direct order. To Colonel Aaron Layfield and his revengers, your duty is to keep Jamie McAllister and his marauders away from Sherman's army. Try to contain the marauders up in northeast Georgia, if at all possible.
Jamie very carefully laid out his plans to the men driving the supply wagons, and they rumbled out. Each marauder carried 5 days' meager rations in his saddlebox to be used only in an emergency. Jamie had given each man money enough to buy food along the way if they had to. Mainly, they would depend on hunting and fishing to sustain themselves. Jamie certainly had ample supplies. He had his men cache supplies and ammunition all over northeast Georgia, from Blue Ridge up near the Tennessee line, down to Gainesville, then over to the South Carolina line and up to the North Carolina border following the river. The citizens of Georgia knew what he was doing and helped Jamie whenever possible. To a person, they despised Layfield and his men. And their opinion of Sherman and his army wasn't much better, for the man had started his campaign of burning everything that stood in his way. On the same day that Sherman and his Union troops attacked the Confederate stronghold of Rocky Face, Jamie and his men were getting into position in a tiny town in East Georgia. Layfield had been trailed by some of Jamie's scouts, and they had learned that the Southern hater was planning to loot and burn the village. Jamie ordered the civilians, mostly older men and women and children, out of town and into ravines about a mile from the settlement. He had some of his smaller men dress up in dresses and bonnets and sashay up and down the streets so Layfield's vanguard would see him and not suspect anything. Layfield had halted his men about a mile from town.
Let us pray. Lord, give my men the strength to wipe this wretched town from the face of the earth, and to teach these southern whores a lesson in humility. Amen. Let's ride!
Layfield rode up to within a few hundred yards of the sleepy little town. One of the ladies parading up and down the boardwalks flipped her dress up and made a hunching motion toward Layfield. And yet another lady made a very obscene hand gesture toward him.
Whores! Filthy southern whores!
Charge, men! Remember, we are doing God's work!
Jamie's marauders cleared 100 saddles during the first volley. Horses reared and dumped their riders to the dirt. Dust and gun smoke limited vision to only a few yards, and that helped to save Layfield's life.
Recall! Recall!
Layfield wheeled his horse and got the hell gone from the dusty, bloody streets of the small town. Jamie had forewarned his men that there would be no pursuit after the ambush, for Layfield's force was much larger than Jamie's four companies of marauders, and out in the open, the marauders stood a good chance of getting badly mauled. They had killed just over 50 Union Revengers and wounded another 50 or so. Jamie ordered all the guns, ammunition, supplies, and horses to be taken. Any money found on the men was to be given to the townspeople. The badly wounded and the dead were loaded into wagons and taken several miles out of town, while one of the lesser wounded was given a message.
You get the hell going and tell Layfield to come get his wounded and see to him. And let me add this. You tell that hypocritical psalm-singing son of a bitch who ramrods your outfit that this war is with me, not against civilian men and women and kids. If he retaliates against this town for what happened today, you have my personal word that I will hunt down every man jack of you and stake you out over an anthill and pour honey over your eyes and let the ants have you. And don't you doubt for one second that I won't do it. You be damn sure he gets a message.
All through the months of May and June 1864, the Marauders and the Revengers fought each other in small battles all over the northeastern corner of Georgia. To the west and the south, the Union Army was slowly clawing their bloody way toward Atlanta. On June the 1st, the Yankees were on the north side of the Chattahoochee River, only a few miles north of the city. But it would take the Union forces almost seven more brutal and bloody weeks to reach the city. They would measure their daily advance in yards, sometimes feet. Atlanta was being evacuated. Jamie and his marauders and Layfield and his revengers had been all but forgotten by Richmond and Washington. For them, the war was each other. But it was about to turn decidedly in Jamie's favor. The Henry rifle had just been introduced, and a train load of them, along with other supplies, was on its way to Sherman's troops, now almost within spitting distance of Atlanta. The train never made it. Jamie and his men blocked the rails and seized tons of supplies and all the Henry rifles and .44 ammunition for them. The Henry lever-action rifle was a marvel, holding 15 rounds in a tube under the barrel. Each marauder carried two in saddle boots and a third in hand across the horn. It gave them awesome fighting power. For counting the rounds and the pistols they carried, each man could now fire over 80 rounds before having to reload, unheard of in those days. Jamie and the marauders set fire to the freight cars and then blew up the locomotive, blocking the Western and Atlantic tracks for several days. The loss of a small train and locomotive did not disturb Sherman nearly as much as the loss of those rifles. He had been counting heavily on them. He sent a courier to Layfield with a message to force the issue with McAllister or be replaced by someone who could do the job. The message stung Layfield, and he immediately came up with a plan. One that he was sure would work. On September the 1st, rebel commanders finally realized the futility of any further holding on, and Atlanta fell. During the night, Confederate troops began slowly retreating. The casualties were staggeringly, unbelievably high. Both sides combined suffered over 75,000 men dead, wounded, captured, or missing. It was an incredibly bloody price to pay. In Virginia, Federal troops were gradually putting the squeeze on Richmond, but the Confederate lines hardened, and they held back charge after charge of Yankees. At the Battle of the Crater, Federal commanders made the mistake of pitting Negro troops against the rebels. That so outraged the Southerners that they threw caution to the wind and charged the Union line and turned what might have been a Federal victory into a slaughter. Finally, the Union troops were forced to build breastworks out of mud and clay and the bodies of their own dead comrades, in an effort to hold back the enraged Southern troops. From behind the bodies of their own troops, the Yankees finally stopped the wild Confederate charge and held for a time. Then the rebels regrouped and came over the top after them in what would be some of the fiercest fighting of that battle. When it was over, the dead Union troops, white and black, would be stacked 12 feet high. All during the summer of 64, Union troops fought against Lee's troops around Richmond, sometimes as close as 4 miles from the Confederate capital, but they could not break through the rebel lines. There were several dozen black regiments fighting against Lee's Army of Virginia, and they distinguished themselves well against the Confederates. Although led by white officers, the black troops often had to act on their own initiative and prove their mettle time and time again. In mid-September, Falcon McAllister and his company of cavalry joined the Virginia fight, as did Wells and Robert, assigned to a colored regiment from Massachusetts. Sam Montgomery Jr. and Pat McKenzie were there, and so were Jorge and Tomas Nunez. They would soon be facing each other across the battle lines of the blue and the gray. The troops of Lee's Army of Virginia would hold on for about 6 more bloody months. There was only one narrow and curving road leading to the small village that Layfield had threatened to destroy, and anywhere along the road was ideal for ambush. He fully expected the marauders to come riding headstrong along the road. Layfield was only a couple of days away from learning a very hard lesson about Jamie McAllister.
It sounds like a trap to me. Who told you this, Will?
It's all over town, and the people are scared, Colonel. Really scared. Most of the younger men are in uniform. Only men in town are real old or those who was bad wounded in the war and sent home.
Layfield must think I'm stupid to fall for something like this. But for the time being, we'll let him think I'm going to blunder into his trap. We handpick the very best woodsmen, 150 men, and go in there. On foot. We leave our horses here.
Jamie knew there was no way 150 men had any chance at all of putting Layfield out of business. But he could not bring his entire command through the timber without running a real risk of being spotted. The day dawned cool, almost cold, and mist hung in pockets all over the mountains. Jamie and his men slipped silently through the dense timber, moving on moccasin feet. They had tightly wound pieces of cloth around the barrels of their rifles to prevent any stray bit of sunlight from reflecting off of metal. Jamie had started 100 mounted men down the road, so Layfield and his men would be all eyes on the road, not suspecting trouble coming up behind them. About a mile from the ambush site, the mounted marauders would swing off, and Jamie and his men in the woods would strike. Jamie crept to within a couple of 100 feet of the ambushers, and silently his men moved up in a line behind them, spread out left and right.
Here they come, men. Get ready.
Stopped. What's going on? They just stopped.
Something is wrong. I feel it.
Layfield stood up. Jamie quickly pulled his rifle to his shoulder and shot him.
Ow!
But just as he squeezed the trigger, Layfield turned and Jamie knew it was not a righteous hit. Layfield pitched forward, rolling down the embankment to the rutted narrow road below. A 150 men poured hundreds of rounds of rifle fire into the ranks of Layfield's Revengers, working closer in the line as they fired. When their rifles were empty as they had planned, 75 started using pistols while 75 were loaded. Soon, the marauders were close enough to touch those Revengers who had not fled in panic across the road to their horses. When the shooting stopped, over 500 of Layfield's men lay dead or wounded.
You played hell, Johnny Reb. The colonel was hard hit. Busted his shoulder and collarbone, but I saw him right off.
He started his personal war, not me.
And he'll end it, too. You mind what I say, McAllister?
Jamie squatted down and opened the man's shirt. He had taken 2 in the belly, and there was no hope for him.
You ain't got long, Yankee. Now tell me, why does Layfield hate me so?
I'll not lie to any man, McAllister. You killed Layfield's brother some years back. And you killed other kin of his, too.
I have no knowledge of ever killing a man called Layfield.
Well, you done it, whether you remember it or not. They was bounty hunters.
Colonel, come take a look at this contraption, will you? It's the damnedest thing I ever did see, whatever it is.
Jamie stepped over the wounded man and made his way over to Husky, who was standing beside a strange-looking piece of equipment on metal and wooden legs. The thing had a huge round metal tube with a crank on one end and a thin metal rod sticking out of the top.
What is that thing?
Damned if I know, Colonel. But these metal tubes is filled with cartridges. There's three cases of the things over yonder.
What caliber?
.45-70.
Jamie went around to the front of the contraption and looked. There were a series of muzzles all in a circle.
For God's sake, Johnny Reb, don't turn that crank. That's a Gatling gun.
A what?
It's a rapid-fire gun. You turn the crank and the barrel revolves and feeds ammunition down that tube. It's a fearsome weapon. Spits out lead faster than anything ever made. That machine thing is gonna kill a lot of slavers like you.
A Gatling gun, huh? Well, whatever the thing is, boys, we've got us one now. Some of you find the wagon they used to bring this thing here and load it up. Take all the ammunition for it. Take all the guns and ammunition from the dead and the wounded. And leave their horses so they can get out of here.
You're not gonna hang us, McAllister?
I don't hang prisoners or civilians, or molest women and kids and old people. I'll leave that to trash like you. Let's go, men!
Aaron Layfield and his revengers were, for the most part, through with this war, as far as being able to mount any type of effective fighting force. But Aaron Layfield had sworn with his hand on the Bible that someday he would kill Jamie E. McAllister. God had told him that was his sole mission in life. Through his pain, not fully dulled with laudanum, he turned to his new sergeant major, one Carl Miller, who had deserted from the Union Army, grown a beard, and join the Revengers.
I will never rest until I can spit on the grave of Jamie McAllister.
I'll be right beside you, Colonel. I ain't got no love for the McAllisters neither.
You're a good man, Sergeant Miller. I'll pray for you. And God damn Jamie McAllister! Damn his black soul to the eternally burning pits of hell!